Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording, and it is 11:27 a.m. and it is Friday, March 9th. And of course, being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. Well, the Nasdaq is breaking up to new all-time highs today, so that's important because it is the only globally significant stock market that has managed to achieve that feat following the big decline that we had in February. So the Nasdaq has been the clear leader in terms of this medium-term bull market that began in 2008. And I think that's important when we think about if we go back and look at the long-term history, or at least the last 10 years, we can see that the Nasdaq bottomed in 2008. The wider market, in fact, bottomed today, 9 years ago. And that's also an important anniversary. So when we think about it in those terms, well, you can also see that the S&P 500 was up in rather robust territory today, but it is still well below where it was back at the end of January. So I think that what we have now seen is a rotation. That was, I think, inevitable when we had that big decline, and the rotation has taken place in two different ways. There has been a further concentration into subscription-oriented businesses and mega-cap technology shares. I think it is worth taking the time to go through and look at some of those chart patterns. So, for example, Amazon has continued to extend its advance, and in fact, it led the Nasdaq. It was breaking up 4 days ago, and it has continued to advance. Now, what we can also very clearly state is that Amazon is prone to large pullbacks, and it is really quite considerably overextended relative to the trend mean. This is by far the largest overextension that we've had in the context of what has been an incredibly impressive advance. Even if we were to look at this on a log scale chart, there is evidence of acceleration. So this is a trend-ending characteristic. This is clearly acceleration. We're in the third psychological perception stage of this medium-term bull market. We have had a further concentration into the leaders. The Nasdaq is leading, and the leaders within the Nasdaq are accelerating. This is an important characteristic. The other index that broke upwards to new recovery highs, excuse me, new all-time highs today was the Philadelphia Stock Exchange's Semiconductor Index. We might think of this index as an index of companies that make machines that make machines. So, for example, if we were to simply look at Lam Research, that's one of the autonomies that's in this sector, and it clearly broke upwards on pretty impressive earnings in here today. So that's extending its advance. When we look at the kinds of companies that are benefiting from the subscription model, Autodesk is certainly among those, and it broke up in emphatic fashion in here this week. Netflix is also a subscription business, and it has done nothing but rise. But again, this is a clear acceleration. It's got a PE of 120, and it's got a B-rated credit. So when we think about it in those terms, it might be B plus, but it is B nonetheless. When we look at the high yield sector, it has been completely inert because companies like Netflix and Tesla have done spectacularly well from this environment where there has been ample availability of credit. Tesla is something I'm writing about in Comment of the Day today, and you can see clearly that it has held this $300 area, but it is not accelerating like Netflix is. In fact, what we can also see is that if we look at the pricing of options, this isn't something that we look at particularly often, but if, for example, you go out, look at 3 month options, and some of the most where the open interest is greatest is in these strikes of about 300 to 330, but then the price tells us that a lot of people are looking at the $300 area. If you take one from the other, you're getting the $300 area, where a lot of these options would become profitable. These put options would become profitable. And there has been a preponderance of downward dynamics within this range over the last year. When we clearly look at it just simply on the weekly chart, the number of blue candles is high, and relative to the size of the white candles, they're larger, and that's despite the fact the price has simply gone sideways. Well, I really do consider both Tesla and Netflix as barometers for risk in the high yield sector. And when they eventually do roll over, then that's likely to be, I think, at least a coincident indicator that we are getting a greater focus on what I think is perhaps the most likely scenario is that we're going to have some tightness coming through in the credit markets. What we're also starting to see is that if we look at the OIS the excuse me OIS spread, then what that gives us an indication of is that at the very short end of the market, there is some tightness starting to come through. And part of the reason for that is because the Treasury, a lot of the bonds that are being issued are very short dated. So that also tells us that there is a supply surge going on in the very short end of the market. And part of the reason that it's happening now is because of the tax structure changes in the USA, because all that money that is being held offshore was being held in short-dated notes, and now it's being repatriated and used to buy back shares. So that is also contributing to a change in the demand dynamics of this very short-term market. Well, it's up now to about almost 50 basis points. Every time it's got above 50 basis points since 2010, it has come right back down. So we're coming to a rather interesting point at the shorter end of the curve. If we, for example, look at swap curves, and again, this isn't something that has been particularly interesting for really quite some time, but it is interesting now. Then we look at the swap curve. It was inverted and negative for at least over 2 years. Now, in the last 2 weeks, it has moved up and is back in positive territory. Well, the swap curve had been contracting steadily since 2000, and now we're looking like a trending environment once more, and that zero bound is a bit of a psychological Rubicon. But what it is also suggestive of is that we are starting to get some tightness coming through in the bond markets. Now, when we look at some of these longer term bond yield charts, what the point that really stands out to me most acutely is the commonality, that it is not simply that the 30-year US Treasury is now testing the upper side of what has been a long term well, it's a medium-term range around 3 years in duration, or that the 10-year has come back up to the top of its range, 5 years in duration. That when we look at the TIPS chart, then it is very similar, and it is coming up to the upper side of a 5-year range. That the 5-year has broken out, and that is a clear breakout from a well-defined range. And then the 2-year has obviously been pricing in the possibility of additional interest rate hikes progressively more aggressively over the course of the last 12 months. So when all of this is taken together, we're starting to get tightness in the bond markets. It has not yet fed through into the equity markets, and it has not yet fed through into the high yield markets. But it will. That, I think, is something that we have to at least pay some due consideration to. And that is why it is also, I think, appropriate to keep an eye on the yield curve spread, that it is now at 62 basis points. It was at 60 last week. We certainly had a pause because there is the potential for the 10-year to play catch up with the 2-year, and that could contribute to the yield expanding rather than contracting. And we are in a period of time where the consumer is doing reasonably well. That by and large, the when we look, and there was a lot of news today about what the wage demand growth is like, and it was moderating a little bit, and it's down to about 2.6%. But part of the reason for that is because of the tax cuts. As a result of the tax cuts, the vast majority of payroll employees in the USA are getting a pay bump of about 2.2%. And if you're getting a pay bump of about 2.2%, well, you don't have quite the same negotiating power to go in and ask for a wage increase on top of that. So that could keep a lid on wage demand growth over the course of the next few months. But because everyone is, and what we can look at is the performance of Amazon, which has been doing very well. Then, for example, if we look at eBay, one of the things that I've learned from monitoring Mrs. Tracy's business is that the demographics that you have in Amazon, eBay, and Etsy are all very different. And this is something that I think we almost, the way we jokingly talk about it around the dinner table at in the Tracy household is that this is the Tracy barometer. That we look at Amazon and the 100 million people that are signed up for Prime, and those are generally speaking the middle to upper class people. What they want is convenience, and by selling on Prime and it is fulfilled by Amazon, then they get that convenience. Generally speaking, what people on eBay are concerned about is price, and the people who shop on Amazon do not shop on eBay. And generally speaking, what they are looking for rather than convenience is the best price for their money. And we can see that eBay has been doing better, that it is picking up. Therefore, the people that cannot afford to have Prime are spending more money on eBay. Then, when we look at Etsy, I think a lot of people are not particularly familiar with Etsy, but Etsy is a maker's market. 75% of the people who sell on Etsy are women, and they are makers. So a lot of what they're making is handmade and commands a somewhat higher price. By and large, your typical Etsy customer is picky. So the number of returns that we get from Etsy are higher than anything else. But what has been abundantly clear over the last month and perhaps maybe 2 months has been that demand for goods on Etsy has picked up considerably. It's up about 100% over the year, over this time last year. And Mrs. Tracy has not been selling anything differently. Well, we can only I think conclude from that that people are spending their tax windfall. That is going to contribute to higher inflation. That is also going to contribute to the velocity of money starting to pick up. This is a lagging indicator. It is reported in arrears, and it is reported on a quarterly basis. So when we look at what is happening on this index, it turned upwards when it was updated in December, and that figure represents what was happening at the end of September. It's not going to be updated again until after the end of the first quarter, and that will represent the end of last year. It's a lagging indicator, but it is beginning to turn up, and it's at historic low levels. It's almost inconceivable that we could have inflation without the velocity of money picking up, because central banking 101 is that central banks have to have enough money in the system to ensure the potential for growth. If the velocity of money is declining, then they can afford to have excess liquidity in the system because it is required to encourage growth. If the velocity of money picks up and that additional supply is not removed from the system, you get inflation. And that is why the Federal Reserve is so cautious about inflation, that they are somewhat puzzled about why it hasn't picked up more, but it's almost inevitable that it is going to pick up eventually. That one of the moderating effects of this of the tax changes has been that it is compressing wage demand growth, at least for the next couple of quarters. And that also is feeding through into the acceleration that we're seeing in these consumer discretionary tech companies. So what we have definitely seen is an uptick in additional demand. Well, when we look around the world then, this is still a rangy environment, broadly speaking. Let's take a look at Europe, for example. Well, the Euro stocks has firmed from the lower side of its range. It is now right in the region of the trend mean. If the US continues to firm, led by the NASDAQ, we could see the S&P 500 getting back up towards its peaks. Then the question would be whether it is going to break out or not. But there is the potential that it could get back up towards its peak. Well, then that is also likely that the European index could also push up towards that 400 area. The FTSE 100 has held the 7,000 level, and it continues to bounce. So far, the bounce has been pretty modest, and it does need to continue to improve from that 7,100 level. There is continued uncertainty about exactly what we can expect from the European project, but the Italian index at least gives us one lesson, and it is that you buy companies, not countries. Italy is the country probably most at risk from a trade war, but so far we haven't had one. There's the risk of a trade war is picking up, and I think that is part of a trend that the USA is increasingly becoming more assertive on an economic front as well as a military front. And I don't think that it is perhaps lost on the majority of people that one of the reasons why any country would want to protect its metal fabrication business is to ensure that it has manufacturing capacity in times of war. And that is something that I think is not given nearly enough consideration. So it isn't simply that it also represents the biggest trade deficit that the US has with other countries, but there is a geopolitical consideration to all of this that really does need to be borne, I think we need to bear in mind. Then when we look at Italy, it has been ranging below 25,000 since 2009, and it is firming in a rather dynamic fashion this week from the region of the trend mean. So there is potential here that it is going to push up on the push on the upside. The Spanish index is also worth keeping an eye on because it has an equally lengthy ranging phase, although that range has been considerably more volatile. It has had a bigger pullback, and it is only just now beginning to demonstrate that support is beginning to come back in. And the Portuguese market has held a progression of higher reaction lows since the middle of 2016, and it is now right in the region of the trend mean. So this is an area where if it's going to find support, it would be a handy place because it would ensure the consistency of that progression of higher reaction lows. When we look around Asia, well, if we're going to have a return to inflationary bias, then I think Japan is an interesting market. It was not able to hold its rally in here today. Generally speaking, when we get news that relationships with North Korea are thawing, then you get a rally, and then it doesn't tend to be held onto. But the market did close up 100 points, and it does continue to hold this 21,000 level. The second section index remains a leading indicator for the Japanese market, and it has unwound much of its overbought condition relative to the trend mean. So there is potential that this is support building, and as long as the 7,000 area holds, we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. The banking sector was in negative territory in here today. It has yet to clearly demonstrate that we are back in a demand-dominated environment, but I think perhaps the more important point is that it has been ranging above 150 for the last 5 years. It has been prone to occasional bouts of volatility. If we do in fact get a return to an inflationary bias, there is the potential for Japan and particularly the banking sector to rally, I think, in a an outsized manner, because it is the country that needs inflation more than any other. If Japan is going to ever tackle the mountain of debt that is sitting on its both its government and corporate books and its banking books, then it needs inflation and it needs it badly. Now, when we look at what the outlook is for inflation, well, perhaps then the continuous commodity index is one of the best barometers. It was right up to test the upper side of its range in here this week and wasn't quite able to hold it. But oil prices firmed in here today, and when we look at the agricultural prices, then when we look, for example, at cocoa, cocoa has staged a rather impressive rally over the course of the last 3 weeks, and it is perhaps now due some consolidation. Sugar prices have not yet rallied. The corn price, wheat price, and soybean prices are increasingly, I think, demonstrating base formation characteristics, with the potential that those bases are going to be resolved on the upside. If we do start to see some of the grains and beans performing in a more dynamic manner, then that is going to start to drive the performance of the continuous commodity index, because it's unweighted. And when we look at, for example, the LME metals index, copper prices have been really quite steady, and but lead has pulled back really quite sharply. Nickel has started to turn around. But as long as this index is finding support in the region of the trend mean, then we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. So there is the I think credible potential for commodity prices to improve, not simply on an individual basis, but on a more sustained basis. The kinds of shares that would benefit from that, well, SDF, or sorry, KNS AG has got base formation characteristics and is pushing up to the upper side of its range. It produces both potash and salt. And of course, with the freezing weather in Europe, salt has been in high demand. Then, if we look at Israel Chemicals, it has a relatively similar pattern. And of course, that is also producing fertilizers. And this has been a sector that has been completely off the radar. Well, when we look at the condition that we have in global markets, where we have a preponderance of accelerating trends within the technology sector and within within the makers of machines that make things sector. So, for example, when we look at 3M, it is firming in a dynamic manner from the region of its trend mean. If we look at Thermo Fisher, it's in a similar condition. We've got a high degree of commonality within this sector. Taiwan Semiconductor, this is the US ADR, has got a similar pattern. And then I also already looked at Lam Research. So these are the kinds of shares that are leading higher, and they've been leading higher for a fair amount of time already. Well, this is a time when people start to look for things that can play catch up. And the commodity sector has been out in the cold for a fairly considerable amount of time already, and particularly the agricultural commodities. So they definitely have potential to play catch up in this environment. But we also have to consider that this is the third psychological perception stage of the medium-term bull market, that there are two potential conclusions. One is that the S&P 500 has pulled back in a dynamic manner, and now we're in a ranging phase. Now, the first is this a first shot across the bow? Do often we see that trends lose consistency at the penultimate high. So, will this index push on to new all-time highs and then lose consistency? Or will we get up to the high and continue ranging? Or was this simply a short-term hiatus and that the market has further to run on the upside? Accelerations tend to surprise on the upside until they stop doing that, and then we get bigger pullbacks. What we can also consider is that if the market accelerates on the upside from here, then we are in bubble territory. And a bubble is, and I do not use the word bubble often. I think it is a completely overused term and should only be used in a very limited set of circumstances. But when we have a condition where yields are rising and credit is becoming less available and short-term money market rates are rising, and we have a condition where equity markets are accelerating higher, then that one of those ca that kind of situation cannot persist indefinitely. I think that that is something that we have to at least begin to pay attention to now, that when we see that these accelerations begin to lose consistency or have larger pullbacks, particularly for the leading shares, well, that is something that cannot simply be ignored. And it would hold out the prospect that we are going to move into a deeper process of consolidation, which could be potentially lengthy. This is, I think, a time to be increasingly where I think disciplined about stops, and that when we do see clear evidence of deterioration, then it is time to really think about having a stop in the market. Because when this is a situation such as we have right now, it is very easy to become, I think, or to fall victim to the allure of the bullish hypothesis, which is that we have a completely different environment, that we have new markets, that there is a that the revolution that we're getting in the retail sector, the revolution that we've had in the subscription model, is going to change the world forever. That it has banished the peak to trough swings that you get in previously highly cyclical businesses. Microsoft is a beautiful example of that. It was a highly cyclical business all the way from the year 2000 and previous to that as well. But particularly from 2000, it did very well when it had new products, and then not so well subsequently. And then it adopted a subscription model in 2016, and the share has done nothing but rise from there. And Adobe is a very similar situation. Its products are invaluable to anyone who's running an online business, because if you run an online business, you are selling photos as much as you are selling products. And you need Adobe's products if you're going to have an online business. So they adopted a subscription model in 2013. The share broke on the upside, and it continues to advance. And it is part and parcel of Amazon's continued success. So it is a leveraged play on Amazon's success, or at least a high beta play. Well, these are all part of the exact same argument. Then, when we look at the machines that make machines, then these are the types of companies that tend to benefit from increasing industrialization. So when we think about the world such as it is, then we definitely can look at, for example, India. And over the very long term, it's a market that has continued to impress on the upside, but it is also subject to acute bouts of volatility, and the index has hit at least a near-term peak, and it is subject to some consolidation. Well, India has a large young population. They have got the real opportunity to develop a digital economy, and that project is well in hand. Well, what they also need is manufacturing, but it isn't going to be the kind of manufacturing that we had 20 years ago, because automation is occurring so quickly. The only way that countries are going to evolve and to ensure that they have jobs for literally billions of young people is to embrace improving governance. The countries that grow their standards of governance in line with their GDP and the size of their working populations are the ones that will thrive, and those that fail won't. the one country that has done best at that is China. The Chinese market, however, is now at a critical juncture. China has demonstrated that it can build infrastructure and it can develop a domestic consumer market and a digital economy out of nothing within the space of only 5 years. But what they are now doing is clamping down on individual liberties. And that is, I think, a warning that they are at least skeptical of the ability of the party to continue to hold on to power when they have developed this digital economy. So China is at a point where I think risks are rising, particularly from an investor's perspective. It has been easy to conclude that China would be able to get things right, that they would be able to control their infrastructure development, their development of a low-end manufacturing sector, the increasing focus on higher valued manufacturing, and the creation of a digital and based consumer economy. All of those have passed off relatively without ease. They are now focusing more on international assertiveness and building a blue water navy, which is something that will take years to complete. But the modernization of the Chinese military is perhaps a worry for some time 10 years from now. Then they are installing cameras to keep an eye on everyone. They're installing artificial intelligence to monitor phone chatter and even utility bills, so that they will know where people are congregating, how long they're staying up at night, how much electricity they're using. And that is all going to be focused on ensuring that the party stays in power regardless of what happens. So with the evolution of the internet, then also you have the evolution of increasing control elements within oppressive regimes. And when you think about the growth of innovation, then these are not mutually exclusive. So when we think about what the risks are with China, we can say that from a perspective of standards of governance, how do we consider what those are? Well, the first would be that governance is dictated by respect for minority shareholder interests. We have that in a large number of countries, and we have it in India, for example. We do not have that in China. It's always handy to have an independent judiciary. You have that, for example, in South Africa, but you don't have that in China. An independent judiciary is a nice thing to have, because if you have a problem with how your minority shareholder interest is being viewed, you can have recourse to the courts. Of course, if you don't have an independent judiciary, you do not have recourse to the courts. The South African index, one of the redeeming qualities of the South African market, despite the fact that you have had a deep deterioration in the standards of political governance and corruption, well, it has been that you have an independent judiciary. And that also has helped to stabilize investor interest. And the Johannesburg All Share is bouncing from the upper side of what it was, a 3-year range in nominal terms. And if we look at that on a currency adjusted basis, the South African index has, or ETF has, pushed all the way back up to test its old peak from 2011. And continues to firm from these areas. So there is the potential that it isn't simply that we're going to have commodities pushing on and representing late in the cycle performers, but that there is also potential for highly cyclical sectors to also perform on the upside. So for example, Africa is just beginning to break up and away from its long-term base formation. And Africa is an interesting market from the very long term, because it is where you have some of the worst standards of governance, and therefore the potential for them to improve. If you get improving standards of governance off such an incredibly low base, then it has a multiplying effect on valuations. And that is where the potential is in Africa. It is also completely underdeveloped. There are only 1,700 companies listed on the entire continent. People tend to think of Africa as a unified whole, but it has tens of countries. And each one of those countries has got its own individual standards of governance. And it is where the majority of people are going to be born in the next 20 to 30 years. If we are going to have increasing standards of living for the majority of people in the world, then we're going to have to see improvement in Africa. That means more roads, more ports, and more industry, and more digitization. And the only way it's going to work is if we have improving standards of governance. In an environment where we have technological innovation and globalization and the disinflation that each of those characteristics leads to, well, then we also have to consider that in order for them to generate growth, we need to have improving standards of governance. Then we also have to know that there are threats to that condition. I really do not believe that it is an overstatement to say that the trend lower in long-term yields is representative of the triumph of disinflation from globalization and industrialization and technological innovation. Well, that has worked beautifully for the emerging markets. The emerging markets pretty much didn't exist before 1980 from an investment perspective. It was really quite difficult to invest overseas. They became much more investable as inflation started to come down, and they embraced both capitalism and globalization. Well, what the boon that that represented for the emerging markets was a death knell for the what are now the rust belts of developed economies. And the I think the way that the status quo embraced bailing out of the banks in 2008 sowed the seeds for the kind of revolution we've had against the status quo in the last few years. Asking people to endure a decade of lost standards of living and lower wages in real terms, while you've also had asset price inflation and rising insurance and education costs, that is too much to ask for a large number of people, and we are now getting revolution against it. The foreclosure crisis in the USA, the austerity crisis inflicted upon the periphery of the Eurozone. Both of those represented, I think, crises for the status quo, that there was a decision made whether to reform the situation or whether to persist with what worked for the previous 20 years. They went with the status quo, and now it is failing. The uptick that we're getting in populism, in racism, xenophobia, anti-immigration, the call for greater independence, less cohesion, all of those conditions can be traced back to just a simple revolution against the status quo, where people are asking, "What about me?" Well, what we've seen so far in the U.S. in particular, where there has been the clear adoption of deficit spending and the acceptance that they are going to double the deficit during this administration, has been, again, it is a refusal to reform. That what the answer to "What about me?" is very clearly, "Here, have some money." And that has essentially ensured that we have not had reform, but rather that it is simply give the people what they want. And that is going to contribute to a greater problem down the line, because it is going to represent a greater move upwards in yields, a more deficits that will need to be funded, and it is going to create a crisis at some point in the future. We're not there yet. Yields have not broken out. Yields have not been rallying for a while. High yield spreads are still contained. So, and we are still seeing accelerating markets. Eventually, those markets will roll over. High yield spreads will be moving higher. Credit conditions will become much tighter. And that is going to contribute to the next recession and potential and the next bear market. And we are in the third psychological perception stage of this medium-term bull. So therefore, this is the time to become more diligent about stops. This is the time to look for signs of acceleration. And when you get an accelerating market, the type of stop to employ is a trailing stop. When you have markets that are just breaking up out of bases, when you're in the third psychological perception stage for the wider market, then it's worth realizing that these are late in the cycle catch-up plays, that they have ample potential to continue to advance, and they will probably keep going and advancing after some of the leaders have rolled over, but that they are not in they're not inviolate, that they will eventually also roll over. Commodities in particular are highly cyclical, so they have potential to rally in the latter stages of the bull market, but that they will eventually also roll over. This is, I think, I don't want to sound the alarm for anyone. This is not, this broadcast is certainly not designed to stoke fear, but rather to simply highlight that there are risks, that we know what the potential is in the medium term. In the long term, we're still in a secular bull market. Now, if we look at, for example, these very long-term charts, and in fact, perhaps much better than that, is to look at the long-term logarithmic scale chart for the S&P 500, and to go back with as much data as we have. So we know that the index is more than capable of going sideways for a decade or longer. It has done that before. Well, we see that, for example, it peaked in 1929, and it didn't break up again to new all-time highs until 1954. Well, that was a significant period. If we simply take the level around 20 on the S&P, it was there at about in 1930, and it broke above 30 in 1950. So it went sideways for 20 years. And it went sideways for 15 years, between 65 and 1980, and it went sideways from 1999 until 2013. Well, one could conclude that the ranges are getting shorter. But the bull markets have lasted on average for about 20 years. And I think that that's also an important characteristic. They can last for anything from 15 to 20 years. So, for example, we had a significant breakout in 1950, and the market rallied until approximately 1965, but the S&P had continued to move higher and didn't really peak until 1972. The Dow Jones had been contained with a glass ceiling from 1965 to 1981. And the S&P 500 went sideways from 1999 to 2013. Well, we've had a significant bull market, and it has been liquidity fueled over the course of the last decade. So when liquidity eventually becomes more or I think less available, then the chances are that we are going to have some repercussions in terms of the bull market. Well, what is, I think, important to look at from this very long-term logarithmic scale is that once we've had breakouts, we have had the index pull back to test the upper side of the range. That did happen in 1953. And it happened again in 1982. One might argue that it happened again in 2016. But could it pull back and test the upper side of the underlying range, which would be a 500-point pullback? That's not beyond the bounds of possibility. So if we're starting to think about what are our worst-case scenarios for the market, then that is what the potential is when the market does eventually roll over. Well, is it going to roll over from 3,000 or is it going to roll over from 2,800? We do not know. Is it going to roll over from 3,500? Again, we don't know. What we do know is that the market has bounced from the region of the trend mean, and it has now posted a higher reaction low, and that there is potential for it to push higher, not least because the Nasdaq has already broken out. It would require a clear downward dynamic to check the Nasdaq's potential for additional upside. And we know that accelerating trends tend to surprise on the upside. So there is potential for the market to push higher from here. The low that we had at the beginning of February is now the major touchstone in terms of the consistency of this trend overall, and a sustained move below it, and most particularly below the trend mean, would be required to question I think the broad consistency of this trend, which has the potential to accelerate further. Now, when we think about the long term, the best way to benefit from long-term bull markets is to at least take some money off the table at medium-term peaks so that you get a very attractive entry opportunity at medium-term troughs. We have, I think, perhaps seen a short-term trough. This is not a medium-term trough. There is absolutely no secular bull market is not punctuated by the occasional bear market. But the more important point is that in a secular bear market, the bear markets are really quite catastrophic, and we saw those in 2003 and in 2008. If we are indeed in a secular bull market, the next recession will create buying opportunities, but probably not on the order of what we saw in 2008 or 2009. And that's, I think, an important consideration. From the perspective of a medium-term investor, there are two particular trends that are certainly benefiting right now. One is the technology sector, led by the subscription businesses and the machines that make machines sector. And then you have the commodity sector, which has ample potential for additional upside. The other sector of the technology market that is still cyclical is biotechnology, and it is firming from the region of the trend mean in a rather dynamic manner in here right now. When we think about what the long-term drivers for a secular bull market are, then it's not that difficult because we have the rise of the global consumer. And with improving standards of governance in the major population centers, that is going to drive demand for just about everything well into the lengthy medium term. We have the rise of technological innovation, and that is why we're seeing that particular source of leadership in the stock market right now, because that is where we have the potential for productivity growth to come through. And then we have the revolution in energy. Well, one of the things that disheartens people is that the improvements that we see in battery technology are slower than we used to have for the evolution in semiconductors represented by Moore's Law. That used to be once every 18 months we'd see the number of transistors double on a chip. But the doubling of energy density in batteries takes about 5 years. Well, that's great when you look at it on the perspective of 10 years, because it will double in 5 years and double again in 10 years, so it'll go up 4 times in 10 years. But when you're looking at it from month to month and year to year, it doesn't look like it's very fast. Eventually, we will get the kind of battery chemistry that will radically transform the energy sector. But it is going to take time. And for as long as it takes, then the oil market is likely to range, and range in a probably in a volatile manner. Now, because we have had some risk taken off the table with the prospect of a a detente in the negotiations with North Korea. That has acted as a tailwind for the oil price in here today. When we look at that medium-term trend, it has bounced from the upper side of the underlying range, and $60 is a big level for oil. As long as it is holding that $60 area, then this remains a reasonably bullish environment. But the rapid pace of the advance has certainly moderated, and I suspect that we're in for a fair amount of ranging. But we also know that it is going to be difficult for oil prices to sustain levels above $100, because a great deal of additional supply starts to become economic above 70, and that quantity only increases the higher that prices move. So I think that is a major consideration, that oil prices are no longer going to represent the kind of headwind to economic growth that they did in the bull market from early 2000s all the way through until about 2014. And that represents a significant tailwind to economic growth. So we know that there are considerable and powerful secular bullish themes that have got the back of this market, that these are the kinds of themes that are going to reassert the bullish environment as whenever we do get a pullback of that I think is meaningful in terms of an investment opportunity. But we also know that there is this question about the quantity of debt that is outstanding, and the fact that we have such high commonality in government bonds, that the corporate sector has increased its debt load considerably over the course of the last decade, and that debt to GDP ratios are on a secular advance because of unfunded liabilities. These are all major questions, and they are eventually going to become pressing, not least in the USA, where deficit spending has become the order of the day and might well become an additional source of questioning in Europe, because the only way that they're going to hold the whole prospect together is to give people what they want. And what people want is simply more money. And where that more money is going to come from is likely to be deficit spending in one way, shape, or form. And eventually that is going to create an environment where we're going to have higher rates. Again, that is what the medium-term risk is against the background of a secular environment where there is the real potential that when we look at the Dow gold ratio, that the next significant peak in equity valuations, something that would hold up the market for a decade, is probably not going to be for at least another decade. And what that would suggest is that when we do get the bigger pullbacks on stock markets, that they will be buying opportunities at least until the mid-2030s on a secular basis. It's at that point that we can make the argument that gold is on a new secular bull market. I personally think that gold is consolidating, and that it has the potential to break above 1400 at some point this year. This to me looks like a base formation. What that suggests is that when we think about the Dow gold ratio, it is not going to go up in a straight line, but that it is more likely to rise than fall over the course of the next decade. And that also suggests that gold will range more than it will trend, but that it has potential for explosive breakouts. And it has been ranging already for a pretty prolonged period of time, so there is the potential that it could break on the upside. And what I found particularly interesting was that it was in mildly positive territory in here today, despite the fact that you had less of a call for safe havens with the North Korean news. I found that rather encouraging, and I'm considering when, rather than if, I'm going to initiate a long position in gold and potentially also silver. I think there's certainly a lot to think about, and this is a time to become, I think, progressively more diligent about monitoring the consistency of charts. I think that is the one big takeaway. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.